Whenever there is a change of administration, pundits and commentators always review the first magical 100 days. Well, what about the first 100 days of the new Congress? This is Bob Dole. I'll be back right after.
Take one. This is Senator Bob Dole. Do TV network exit polls jeopardize our electoral system? Senator Ted Kennedy... Blah, 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 blah. Take two. This is Senator Bob Dole. Do TV network exit polls jeopardize our electoral system? Senator Ted Kennedy and I will face off on that question in a minute. Ted, we've seen exit polling by the TV networks reach full bloom in this Democratic presidential primary season. I believe the voters should decide an election, not computers and the media. The responsibility of television news is to report results, not shape them. Announcing results while the polls remain open is unfair to candidates and the public. It violates the sanctity of that hard-won process which is the basis of our liberty. Computers have a vital and growing role in our society, no doubt about it, but their use by the media to bend and shape the will of the people should not be one of them. Senator Kennedy, don't you agree the network should be satisfied to report and not create news?
Let's try this level. I don't know yet. Check one, two, test. All right, take one, new level. This is Senator Bob Dole. Do TV network exit polls jeopardize... Blah, 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 blah. Check one, two. Three, two, one. This is Senator Bob Dole. Do TV network exit polls jeopardize our electoral system? Senator Ted Kennedy and I will face off on that question in a minute. Ted, we've seen exit polling by the TV networks reach full bloom in this Democratic presidential primary season. I think the voters should decide an election, not computers and the media. The responsibility of TV news is to report results, not shape them. Announcing results while the polls remain open is unfair to candidates and the public. It violates the sanctity of that hard-won process that is the basis of our liberty. Computers have a vital and growing role in our society, no doubt about it, but their use by the media to bend and shape the will of the people shouldn't be one of them. Ted, don't you agree the networks should be satisfied to report and not create news? All right, check one, two, new level, check one, two. Blast it this way. Take one. This is Senator Bob Dole. Do TV network exit polls jeopardize our electoral system? Senator Kennedy and I will face off on that question in a minute. Ted, we've seen exit polling by the TV networks reach full bloom in this Democratic presidential primary season. I believe the voters should decide an election, not computers and the media. Ted, the responsibility of TV news is to report the results, not shape them. Announcing results while the polls remain open is unfair to candidates and the public. It violates the sanctity of that hard-won process which is the basis of our liberty. Computers have a vital and growing role in our society, no doubt about it, but their use by the media to bend and shape the will of the people shouldn't be one of them. Ted, don't you agree the TV networks should be satisfied to report and not create the news, you jerk?
The problems facing many senior citizens. And their discussions with legislators and with staff members help focus particular attention on such issues as Social Security, housing, and transportation, issues that will certainly increase in importance as the nation's older citizens continue to represent a growing share of our population. This is Bob Dole. Thanks for listening. Concern has been growing over the extent of the so-called underground economy and tax evasion schemes. This is Bob Dole, and I'll be back right after this. It is not clear what is in the underground economy, but it at least includes income from illegal activities, unreported income earned in second jobs, and exchange of services without a taxable transaction. In each of these cases, business is structured so that any income generated escapes the tax system. Now, no one likes to pay taxes, and there will always be a certain percentage of the population who seek to evade the tax system. But the key to the success of our income tax has always been the willingness of the American people to pay their fair share of taxes. Without voluntary compliance, enforcement would be much more strict than it is, and much more likely to interfere with our liberties. That is why growth of the underground economy is a matter of such concern to Congress. The Commissioner of Internal Revenue, Roscoe Egger, hopes to improve enforcement techniques to deal with the underground economy. But this is not the only answer. Americans pay taxes out of a sense of obligation and fair play. Nothing undermines this sense of fair play so much as the lack of candor from the government. In recent years, people have become aware that tax cuts have not been real tax cuts, because inflation not only erodes income, it increases the tax bite for every individual. As a result, there is less incentive for work and more incentive for having some income on the side that is not subject to those high marginal rates. We have to get these tax rates down, and we have to keep the tax burden stable so that people understand what their tax obligation is and will be aware when they get a real tax cut. For too long, we've allowed the tax burden to rise automatically without owning up to the fact. We cannot condone tax evasion, but if we want American taxpayers to deal honestly with the government, we have to deal fairly in return. This is Bob Dole. Thanks for listening. For years, many people have said we cannot balance the federal budget because political will was lacking. But the Senate Judiciary Committee has taken an important step toward balancing the budget. This is Bob Dole, and I'll be back right after this. On May 19th, the Judiciary Committee approved Senate Joint Resolution Number 58, a proposed constitutional amendment that, if adopted, would dramatically increase the odds in favor of fiscal discipline and restraint in taxes. This amendment was drafted in response to petitions from the states for a constitutional convention on this issue and reflects the good work done by the Senate Balanced Budget Caucus over the past several years. As a sponsor of this amendment, both this year and last, I am pleased the full Senate will have an opportunity to consider the proposal. Senate Resolution 58 is a good, straightforward proposal. It limits the power of Congress to run a deficit by requesting a 3/5 vote and makes Congress accountable for tax increases by requiring a record vote to increase the level of taxation. Now, this is not an attempt to write economic policy into the Constitution. It just alters the political rules to make Congress more accountable for levels of spending, deficits, and taxes. The goal is to make Congress more responsive to the will of the people without putting the legislators in a straitjacket. The American people strongly favor spending restraint, an end to deficits, and lower taxes. The Reagan administration is responding to those demands, and I hope Congress will follow through. But in the meantime, it makes sense to develop the best possible proposal for making fundamental improvements in the management of our fiscal affairs. The action by the Senate Judiciary Committee gives us an opportunity to do just that, and we ought to make certain that the opportunity is not wasted. This is Bob Dole. Thanks for listening. All across the nation, farm families are making plans for it. Preserves are being canned, calves are being fattened, tomatoes ripened. County fair time is just around the corner. This is Bob Dole, and I'll be back right after this. Rural America has many unique customs, but few are more enjoyable than the county fair. It is a time when the entire community takes a few days to celebrate its agricultural industry. Nobody stays away from the fair. Rural America traditionally make a huge contribution to the success of most county fairs. At many of these events, the selection of the grand champion steer, hog, horse, or other livestock, depending upon the region, is one of the real high points of the whole fair. Of course, of equal importance is the best groomed girl, the prize-winning loaf of bread, and various other projects of the young ladies. But the county fair goes beyond all of these things. In reality, it is rural America putting its best foot forward. The fair gives everyone in towns and cities across the nation a chance to see what is the latest and best from our farms and ranches. For instance, where else can non-farm people see firsthand what a grand champion dairy cow looks like? From the machinery displays, they have a chance to see just how sophisticated modern farm implements really are, and at the same time, get an idea of how much they cost. Being located in the nation's capital, I personally wish there was a way that our elected officials and bureaucrats could attend a few county fairs to see what American agriculture is all about in 1981, and also to talk directly with America's farmers. I think this experience would give them a new appreciation for the contributions of farmers today. I hope your 1981 county fair will be the best ever. This is Bob Dole. Thanks for listening. Greece recently joined the European community, and over the next few years, Spain and Portugal will follow. This will create a whole new ball game for U.S. agricultural exports. This is Bob Dole. I'll be back right after this. The nations of the European community are not only a major buyer of U.S. farm products, they're also a rival on the international markets for some products. Greece has recently joined the community, and Spain and Portugal will follow. And the addition of these nations will make the European community much stronger agriculturally. You see, agricultural production in the previous nine-nation bloc concentrated heavily on livestock and grain. But the three new countries produce more fruits, vegetables, nuts, tobacco, and other non-grain crops. In addition, the membership of Greece, Spain, and Portugal will bring a 60% increase in agricultural land to the community. Last year, the 12 European nations, which will make up the European community, took over $11.5 billion worth of our farm products. That is more than one-fourth of all our export sales in 1980. There are a number of factors which will affect our market, but chief among them is the bloc's common agricultural policy. It does two things. First, it encourages trade among the community members. Secondly, it increases agricultural production and subsidizes European exports through price supports and direct payments to farmers. As a result, the current nine-nation bloc are likely to look to the new members as a source for the products they produce. In other words, our fruit, nut, vegetable, and tobacco growers will have a harder time selling their products in Europe. In addition, our grain and livestock products will face stiffer competition in the three new member nations. Of some concern also are U.S. soybean exports to Europe. The new members produce olive oil, which can be substituted for soybean oil, but probably the toughest competition will come in the area of fruits, vegetables, and nuts. Not only will the United States producers face competition on the European markets, but also the bloc is likely to be a tough rival on the international market. This is Bob Dole. Thanks for listening. Did you know that Medicare will cost approximately $41 billion this year? This is Bob Dole, and I'll be back right after this. The Medicare program assists many millions of elderly and disabled Americans in obtaining health care services. As a result of Medicare, the health of the aged and the disabled has improved noticeably since the program began. It has also played a role in establishing minimal quality standards for hospitals and nursing homes and has enforced non-discriminatory provisions of services in hospitals. Yet Medicare has not been without its shortcomings. Although Medicare was not designed to provide long-term care services, its failure to address the long-term care needs of the elderly has been the greatest criticism of the program. However, unless we are able to get a handle on the enormous costs of existing acute care benefits, we will be unable to expand benefits, no matter how desirable or meritorious. After much discussion and deliberation during the last several weeks, the Senate Finance Committee chose to recommend certain changes in Medicare, which result in a savings to the program of about $2 billion in 1982. Only about $300 million of the amount, however, will directly affect Medicare beneficiaries. This represents less than 1% of the total program costs. The balance of the savings will be realized through changes in program administration and policies and coordination of benefits with private health insurance. The recommended changes take on additional significance in view of the financing problems facing the overall Social Security system, of which Medicare is a very important part. In view of this problem, it's not too early to begin to phase in limited program changes to assure the stability of this vital program. I believe the changes made are reasonable and help us to ensure the future of this very important health care program for the aged and disabled. This is Bob Dole. Thanks for listening. We all know that mandatory fuel conservation measures have helped reduce gasoline consumption in America. But did you know that those same measures have aggravated the growing problem of highway deterioration? This is Bob Dole. I'll be back right after this. It is widely acknowledged that the deterioration of our nation's highways is outpacing the financial ability of states to repair or replace rundown roadways and bridges. Fuel efficiency standards and the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit has successfully saved gasoline. But because money for highway repairs and maintenance comes from the tax on gasoline at the pump, fuel savings have meant fewer maintenance dollars. That, combined with inflation and rising repair costs, has made it impossible for many states to keep pace with increasing highway repair needs. As a result, many states have reduced their highway budgets by cutting back on highway staff, especially maintenance personnel. This leaves most states unable to keep up with filling the estimated 93 million potholes in our country, much less billions of dollars of major repair work. Congress began to address this problem in 1976 when it recognized the need for federal help with major repairs as well as new construction. The Resurfacing, Restoration, and Rehabilitation Program began in 1976 and was an important first step toward maintaining our nation's highways, but it is not enough. This year, Congress will tackle President Reagan's proposal to increase funds available for major highway repairs by delaying completion of our interstate highway system. Rural areas should benefit from this approach because most of the incomplete interstate system is in metropolitan areas, while highways in rural areas that were completed years ago are badly in need of repair. Without changes in the highway law, highways in rural areas will continue to fall apart, while taxpayers subsidize construction of 8- and 10-lane superhighways, costing up to 100 times more per mile than the interstate highways we already have. With the interstate system already 95% complete, it makes more sense to preserve what already exists. This is Bob Dole. Thanks for listening. When this nation was founded 205 years ago, agriculture was the industry. While the great nation we have today has many industries, I think it's significant that agriculture is still our most productive sector. This is Bob Dole, and I'll be back right after this. The 4th of July has always been a very special holiday to rural Americans, and that's appropriate, since almost everyone back in 1776 was a farmer, including George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. Now, these gentlemen, our founding fathers, are recognized today as perhaps history's greatest visionaries, but I doubt very much that they could possibly, even in their wildest imagination, have foreseen what farming is like today. Can you picture even the inventive genius of Thomas Jefferson comprehending the complexity of the latest self-propelled combine? Think how he and other farmers of his day would be amazed at 200 bushel per acre corn, or cows, which individually produce thousands of pounds of milk each year. Now, George Washington was a large landowner, and it took many workers to farm only a few acres of his holdings. I'm certain our first president would find it incredible that one person now can farm hundreds of acres single-handedly. Yes, there are many things in 1981 that Washington, Jefferson, Franklin, and others couldn't possibly have imagined, but there are certain things they could predict. They knew, for example, that a society of free men and women offered the best hope of creating an atmosphere where creative genius could flourish. They knew that the right to own land was essential to the stewardship of that most precious of all natural resources. And probably most important of all was their belief that a free society, where each person is created equal, could govern itself effectively. All of us, whether we live on a farm or in the city, owe a debt to these men of vision. We can repay them by helping to make certain that the principles they set down 205 years ago are passed on to future generations. Happy 4th of July. This is Bob Dole. Thanks for listening. Last year, food prices at the store rose 8%. As usual, the prices farmers received was the smallest contributing factor to the increased cost of food. This is Bob Dole. I'll be back right after this. In 7 out of the last 10 years, farmers contributed the least of several factors to the continually rising cost of food at the retail level. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, last year was no exception. I wager that most of you who are farmers knew this fact last January when you did your final books for the year. 1980 was not a banner year for most farmers. Anyway, here are the facts for 1980. Retail food prices rose by 8%. Which was considerably lower than the nation's rate of inflation. Less than 20% of the rise in food cost was attributed to the cost of farm produce. Marketing costs, processing, labor, transportation, and the like accounted for more than half of the increased price in food. As far as farm prices are concerned, the major element keeping its contribution to the total down was the cost of meat last year. Traditionally, meat is the biggest single item in the average American's food budget. Larger quantities of pork and poultry kept meat prices down. As for beef, the quantity and price was about the same as the previous year. Incidentally, for those of you who are sharp with figures, you may have noticed that we have accounted for only about 80% of the rise in food prices. The rest come from the large increases in prices for fish and imported foods. In general, livestock producers receive a greater share of the final food product dollar than do producers of other commodities. For example, cattle feeders receive about 61 cents out of every consumer dollar spent on beef. On the other hand, wheat farmers get only about 9 cents out of every dollar spent on a loaf of white bread. In any event, while you may have a hard time convincing some of your friends in the city, food is still a comparatively good buy. After all, our total food bill rose only 8%, and that is considerably less than most other consumer goods. This is Bob Dole. Thanks for listening. The 1980 census showed that for the first time in 160 years, the number of people in rural areas actually increased at a faster rate than in metropolitan areas. That turnaround, if it continues, could have substantial political ramifications. This is Bob Dole. I'll be back right after this. Despite the fact that there are fewer farms and farmers, the 1980 census showed that for the first time in 160 years, rural populations increasing faster than metropolitan areas. Since the United States House of Representatives is based on population, eventually the increased growth rate in rural areas will be reflected in Congress. If the trend continues through the 1980s, it will create a profound effect in the next decade. Now, some of the so-called rural gains are in areas considered country, but close to large urban centers. In another 10 years, these areas are likely to have developed enough to be true suburbs. Nevertheless, experts say there is still a major trend developing in rural areas. As we've mentioned in previous commentaries, this shift has had both negative and positive effects on the quality of life in rural America. And politically speaking, the trend will have a good and bad aspect for the American farmer. For example, the number of congressmen from rural areas will increase, and this is good. However, with a constituency that is more diverse, the representative is going to reflect the wider interest of his or her district. But in the end, I can't help but believe it will be politically beneficial for farmers. Certainly, if a congressman has at least some farmers in his district, he is more likely to be concerned with the interests of all farmers than he is now. Still, another point is that farmers and farm groups should have an easier job of explaining their point of view to non-farm residents. It just makes sense to me that it's easier to discuss an issue with a non-farmer who lives nearby than trying to communicate to someone who lives in an apartment in the city. I doubt that we'll ever see the day when the farm bloc will have the same power in Congress it did a few decades ago. But it would be good for all of us to have more representatives from down on the farm. This is Bob Dole. Thanks for listening. I'll admit it. Coming from Kansas, I like to talk about wheat, cattle, and our other major farm products. But you've got to give credit to the egg producers for being among the most efficient in the farm sector. This is Bob Dole, and I'll be back right after this. Those of us interested in farming and agriculture are proud of its record of productivity and efficiency. Now, one segment of agriculture that I think we sometimes take for granted is the egg producer. Theirs is a business of high volume and extremely narrow profit margins. Unfortunately, all too often, the profit margin dips into the loss column. Yet despite this fact, the American public continues to enjoy abundant supplies of reasonably priced eggs. Now, how abundant are they? Well, last year, the industry produced a record of almost 70 billion eggs for sale. A few were exported, but if we had consumed them all here at home, it would have meant that each person would have eaten over 300 eggs just last year. A moment ago, I mentioned that nearly 70 billion eggs were produced in this country. The interesting point is that record production was achieved with fewer laying hens. Without exception, the industry has become more productive every year. For example, in 1970, the average hen laid 218 eggs in a year. Last year, that figure had risen to 244 eggs per year. The increase is a result of continuing improvement of breeding stock, feed nutrition, and management practices. Based on past performance, it is likely that even more improvements will be made in the future. For example, scientists are currently working on various projects to make eggshells harder. You see, the 70 billion eggs last year did not include those which are broken before they got to market. In fact, it is estimated that as much as 10% of the eggs laid are broken before they ever get into a carton. Now, if in the future fewer eggs are broken, fewer hens will be needed to produce the same amount of the product. It is this kind of efficiency improvement which has allowed egg producers to stay in business despite the razor-thin profit margins. Yes, it is the incredible edible egg, but so is the industry which produces them. This is Bob Dole. Thanks for listening. I'm delighted to say that finally there is a viable wheat industry council which will help educate the public about wheat. This is Bob Dole, and I'll be back right after this. On March 1st of this year, the Wheat Industry Council opened its doors for business. Its mission will be to conduct research on the nutritional value of wheat products and to educate and inform the public on the tremendous benefits of these products. Oh yes, if we happen to increase our per capita consumption of wheat as a result of the efforts of the council, I won't be disappointed. Let me give you a little background. For years, various agricultural commodity and product groups have had organizations which promote the use and consumption of their products. You've no doubt seen ads and read articles about the many attributes of cotton, milk, and eggs. Actually, the list goes on and on. Even the potato industry promotes its product. Now, the way these organizations work, generally speaking, is that they are created by an act of Congress, provided with startup money which is to be paid back to the federal government in a specified period of time. The federal money is repaid, and ongoing programs are funded by voluntary industry assessment. All research, information, and education programs sponsored by the organization are supervised by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, even when the organization becomes self-supporting. Now, I have worked with many others here in Washington for many years to create the Wheat Industry Council. Hopefully, in a few years, we'll have a $10 million budget to carry out its mission. In the case of the council, the funds to support its activities will be collected from the end product manufacturers, that is, bakers, the cereal manufacturers, the biscuit and cracker companies, and the pasta makers. All of these companies will be asked to contribute voluntarily based on their volume to the council. Incidentally, the Wheat Industry Council is forbidden by law to lobby or in any way influence Congress or government agencies on legislation or regulations involving wheat or wheat products. I hope it won't be long until we're all learning about the value of wheat products in our diets. This is Bob Dole. Thanks for listening. A commencement speaker generally imparts words of glittering generalities. Rarely do remarks of real substance shine through the sea of graduation rhetoric. But an exception occurred when the commencement speaker was the Chief Justice of the United States. This is Bob Dole. I'll be back right after this. A few weeks ago, Chief Justice Warren Burger was a commencement speaker at the George Washington University School of Law. Instead of repeating the usual inspirational remarks to his audience, Justice Burger instead chose a deadly serious topic, what to do about the deplorable state of our nation's prisons and jails. This is a subject which I too have focused on and which led to the introduction of legislation which would provide federal financial and technical assistance for state and local correctional construction programs. The Chief Justice suggested that that approach might cost a great deal of money and that 1981 was hardly the year in which to propose large public expenditure for new programs to change the physical plant and internal programs of penal institutions. Instead, he proposed the establishment of a central federal facility for the training of prison personnel, similar to the FBI Academy program for state and local police personnel. He then called for mandatory basic education subjects to be taught to functionally illiterate inmates. The Chief Justice's argument is compelling, to say the least. Correctional personnel operate in an extremely harsh and artificial workplace, very often in an isolated area. The pay is as low as any to be found in public service. The burnout and turnover rate is excessively high, sometimes 40 to 50% a year. It makes good sense to establish a national correctional academy, or perhaps regional academies, which could well be a significant tool for the professionalization and morale of the corrections community. Inmate education is a much more substantial undertaking. Many correctional facilities simply do not have the physical plant, instructional staff, or dollars to tackle this mission. Educational television might fill the gap here. Although Justice Burger was speaking to a small group of highly motivated law graduates, his message was much broader. All of us should heed his remarks. This is Bob Dole. Thanks for listening. When Congress passed the Airline Deregulation Act in 1978, small communities across America feared that they would be abandoned by large airlines hungry for more lucrative urban markets. This is Bob Dole, and I'll be back right after this. 1981 may someday be known as the year of deregulation, but the airline industry is already entering its third year of operation under the Airline Deregulation Act. Opponents of this bill had feared that rural areas would soon be suffering from a severe loss of needed service, but for the most part, those fears have not become a reality. This is not to say that airline deregulation has no critics. From all indication, though, airline traffic in rural areas is quite healthy, and small commuter airlines have taken up the slack when the larger companies have cut off service. In short, this act has left us with little reason to believe that the private sector is not capable of regulating itself better than the federal government can. Rural Americans, though, have every reason to study closely any attempt to deregulate a vital service. It is only logical that an airline, for instance, would rather not operate in a region that cannot generate enough income to pay its cost. To protect rural areas, the Airline Act guaranteed that all cities served in 1978 would retain that service for at least 10 years. But that guarantee hasn't been needed in most cases. In fact, smaller commuter carriers now serving these areas are actually better suited to handle this kind of traffic. By using smaller, more efficient planes, they are offering more flights to more places. Finally, supporters can point to the millions of taxpayers' dollars saved. With the inflation and fuel prices soaring higher than a DC-10, it's no wonder that many Americans have been skeptical about the success of airline deregulation. Overall, though, it's had a smooth flight in small-town America. This is Bob Dole. Thanks for listening.